Welcome to Whitley on Wine. I'm your host, Robert Whitley. My guests today are winemakers Philip Laffer and Bernard Hicken of Jacobs Creek Winery in the Barossa Valley, way down in Australia. Okay, Phil, why don't we start with you? Why don't you tell us the Jacobs Creek story? Because here in the United States, our introduction to Jacobs Creek was at the lower levels, and those wines were good, and they were great value for the money. But we know that Jacobs Creek makes other wines, and also Jacobs Creek hasn't always been Jacobs Creek. So why don't you take that and run with it?
Well, we're quite right, because, I mean, the company itself was founded in 1847. That's over 160 years old. And it was founded on Jacobs Creek, and that was the only connection. There was a vineyard called Jacobs Creek, but as a brand, it didn't exist. And it came into being in 1976 as a single red blend, part of a collection of wines that were named after various vineyards that the company owned. All the others failed, fell apart, and what was left was Jacobs Creek. And that was very successful. It was sold generically in those days as a claret, but also with varietal attachments.
It was a claret, but did it have Shiraz in it?
It was Cabernet, Shiraz, and Malbec.
Yeah, okay, that's stretching the definition a little bit.
Exactly, and you had to call it claret then because Australians wouldn't have known what it was.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we drank claret, we drank Burgundy, and this was because it was in a claret bottle, this was claret.
Well, you know, that's very similar to the United States. There were wines that were called BV, Beaulieu Vineyard, had a red Burgundy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, it didn't have any Pinot Noir in it, but it was red Burgundy.
Well, Australia was very generic then, and in fact, Jacobs Creek, Cabernet, Shiraz, Malbec was one of the first wines to actually put the varietal descriptor on the label, and it started a trend where fairly quickly, within 15 years, we dropped off these generic names, and all Australian wines were described primarily by the variety that they were made from.
Mm-hmm.
So that started off as a domestic-only product. It was so successful that then, bit by bit, other varieties were added to it. Initially, there was a Riesling tacked on, then a Chardonnay and a Semillon Chardonnay, so it actually became progressively a brand. We launched it very successfully into the United Kingdom in the late 1980s after a couple of abortive starts. And it was so successful that it limited our ability to expand Jacobs Creek in a whole lot of other markets around the world.
And because the Brits wanted more of it.
The demand was so great. And we starved the United States of Jacobs Creek wine. One of the reasons that Jacobs Creek is perhaps where it's positioned at the moment in the United States is that UK was dragging so much wine and no one was game to put a halter on that, or a lease on that, that we starved the United States. In hindsight, to our detriment, but then I don't know that we had a choice. So it was more in the mid-90s where we started to get very serious in terms of United States, and probably around about 1998, we had sufficient wine to launch ourselves here. And as Bernard will confirm, we've been very, very disciplined about style and quality in Jacobs Creek. And if it's meant that we couldn't produce wine of a certain quality, then we'd rather forego the sales than put at risk what we see as a 50-100-year brand. So there were grapes available, but not of a quality that would meet the Jacobs Creek standards.
Now, what attracted you to Jacobs Creek? And I should let everyone know that at one time you worked for the enemy. You were in the Hunter Valley, or the Hunter. How do you pronounce that?
Hunter Valley, but
Well, you know, in Australia, they don't say Hunter Valley. anyway, you were at Lindemann's, and there was a change of ownership, and you ended up going to Jacobs Creek, as I understand it.
Well, I went to Orlando. Orlando and Lindemann's, which in those days was a standalone company, were sort of head-on competitors in the sense that there was admiration between both companies because we were both strong white wine-producing companies. And at Lindemann's, we'd always measure ourselves against what Orlando was doing, and I've since discovered they were doing a little bit the same.
By the way, some of those Lindemann's, those older Lindemann's Semillons and Rieslings are just amazing wines, and I'm sure that your hand was in on most of those.
Yeah. So when Lindemann's was sold, and I had nothing against where it was going, but I knew it would become a brand and not a culture and not a personality. It was a sensible time to leave. When the people in Orlando approached me, it was a very easy decision because I had admiration for their winemaking. And I was fascinated by Jacobs Creek, which by that time was becoming, I mean, it was you know, we say 400,000 cases sounds small, but in those days, a 400,000 case brand was a big brand, and it was growing rapidly. So it was a very easy decision for me to say, yep, I'd love to work for Orlando.
And Bernard, you were already there working for Orlando mm-hmm. when Correct. Philip came in.
Yep.
How was that transition? And what did he bring to the table coming in from a completely different region like the Hunter Valley, which is so different than the Barossa Valley where Jacobs Creek is located?
Mm. Well, firstly, Philip's contribution, I think, is basically sticking to the principles of making great wine and making traditional wine and making classic wine. Mm-hmm. I think that was a you know, terrific sort of discipline since Philip's been with us. And just going back to Jacobs Creek, when it first was released back in 1976, there were certain fundamentals or principles of winemaking that we set for the product. And one of them being that the wine was to be soft, easy, and approachable to drink, and hence the use.
Doesn't that describe all Australian wine?
Well, these days it does, but you know, back in those days, there were some wines which were, you know, may have been some of the reds may have been recommended for cellaring for three or 4 years.
Sure. And even today, I mean, you know, there are a lot of Australian wines, Grange, for example, that will last for 40 years. So.
Yeah, and so that's the reason that we used Malbec back in those early days, because we knew that that variety deliberately would make the wine soft and approachable. So there was a framework which we actually decided on when we released this wine, that it would be high quality, the wine would be consistent, but also very approachable. And I think Philip coming on board has made us really stick to the principles of fine winemaking, that the best wines come from the best vineyards and never, you know, deviate from the basic fundamentals of good winemaking. And that's, I think, you know, really reinforced the brand over the years, which has been on the market now for over 33 years. And it's been very successful through that process, obviously, because from a winemaking perspective, we've stuck to the basics of making high-quality wine from high-quality vineyards and never deviated from that principle.
Now, you've emphasized vineyards a couple of times. Do you own most of your own vineyards, or do you have long-term contracts, or do you... Where do you source your grapes?
No, it's in fact, Jacobs Creek, most of the fruit is from private growers. Mm-hmm. And our private estate vineyards would only equate for less than 20% of our total fruit intake. Those own company vineyards or estate vineyards would tend to be the premium or the super premium. Mm-hmm. Vineyards, we would target, for example, Jacobs Creek Reserve or the Jacobs Creek Heritage Range, which is our very special range of wines under Jacobs Creek. The Jacobs Creek Classic or Core Range, which is readily available in all markets, that's where we'd have a high proportion of private growers who actually contributed to the blends of Jacobs Creek.
Phil, did you have any period of adjustment when you got there dealing with, say, fruit from the Barossa as opposed to the Hunter Valley?
Well, two things I'd just say. First of all, I didn't have to teach these people how to make wine. I mean, they, in fact, taught me some things. And Lindemans in those days, whilst it was sort of Hunter, it was also Barossa, and it was a fairly broadly based company, mm-hmm. very much the way Orlando was. So I'd had experience with other regions. I mean, you always have to adjust a little bit to a culture. But there wasn't a big difference in culture, because the important bit of the culture is how people think about wine. Are the winemakers technicians, or are they in fact passionate winemakers?
Mm-hmm.
And within Orlando, they were passionate winemakers. You know, there were a couple of technicians. You always got to have a couple of technicians, but you really want the rest of the people to be pushing, you know, the envelope all the way. And I guess the role that I fulfilled as chief winemaker, and that Bernard now is encouraging that, but also applying the discipline, and at times saying, look, that's a great idea, but that's not Jacobs Creek. You know, Jacobs Creek has an absolute style that we adhere to. It evolved. If we want to change it, then we think about it very carefully. We don't go willy-nilly and say, wow, that's a good wine. That's the direction we'll go. It's encouraging innovation, but also providing the discipline that says, well, hang on, great idea, but is it Jacobs Creek?
Yeah. So, Bernard, that leads me to a question, and I think you make a very good point, Phil. You were there in the beginning when Jacobs Creek started in the mid-1970s. How has the personality or the identity of Jacobs Creek changed between then and now? We're talking 30-some years.
Well, that's interesting because with the wine itself, when we do verticals, when we do a vertical tasting as such, which means we could get, say, 20 vintages and taste the Jacobs Creek Shiraz Cabernet, for example, over 20 years, we find that there is a theme right through the wine, which we've never lost, and in terms of the style, the flavour of Australian vineyards, the fact that the wines are very varietal and fresh, and they're not overripe or jammy or high in alcohol. We've always harvested the fruit at the right time and not left it too late. And that theme is always followed through, but the fruit is actually ripe enough so that the wines are soft and approachable for ready drinking. And that theme is really followed all the way through. Now, naturally, styles do evolve over time. And the way we tend to look at it is that they will evolve with the contemporary needs of the consumer. So as the consumer moves on to maybe slightly less oak or slightly less alcohol, slightly fresher, more aromatic wines, which we see the trends in the marketplace, naturally we all tend to sort of gravitate towards those more contemporary styles. And if we do decide to make a shift based on the way that consumer trends are going, it won't be a large shift in one point in time. It will be a gradual movement from one place to another, maybe over 5 to 7 vintages to move to a more contemporary style.
Well, one of the things I was going to say, and you sort of took it right out of my mouth, is that the Jacobs Creek wines have an elegance to them that, belies the fact that a lot of the fruit comes from the Barossa Valley. And many of your contemporaries in the Barossa Valley make very ripe, high alcohol wines. And who set the style for Jacobs Creek that you now have and that you've had for a long time that really kind of bucks that trend?
Well, I think that it's really that we've never sort of fallen into the trap of making overripe, high alcohol, jammy wines. We always believe, as I mentioned before, that we would stick to the fundamentals of making wines that are balanced and ripe, not green, and not overripe. So there is a point in time which the vineyard peaks in terms of varietal flavour, in terms of natural acidity, in terms of ripe tannins, and that's the time that you harvest the fruit. Now, there's nothing new about that. That's been going on in France for hundreds and hundreds of years. If you deviate to the green side, you'll end up with green, immature flavours. If it's overripe, you'll have jammy, high alcohol overripe wines. So there's nothing new in what we're doing. We are sticking to the traditional, I guess, classic approach to making balanced wines with varietal flavour. And we've seen some of the winemakers in the Barossa going for these riper, sort of more high alcohol styles. They're wines that generally won't age all that well. And also, I think these days, people who love to drink wine and love to lead a healthy lifestyle in terms of exercise and eating healthy food and love drinking quality wines, are now saying, well, wait a minute, what is the alcohol in this wine? They are starting to look at the bottle and see what the alcohol level is, and in some cases making decision on whether they buy that wine, whether it's on the basis that it may be too high in alcohol. And so that's, I think, another thing that we are well aware of. In fact, with our wines at the moment, we're looking to see what we can do in the vineyard to try to maximise the ripeness of the fruit at a moderate alcohol level. I'm not saying low, but just at an alcohol level that is in balance with the fruit flavour in the wine. And I think that is very important.
I hear from readers of my wine column all the time about the alcohol levels, but there are also people who are fans of Two Hands style of wine, and they certainly have their place. And I like all of it, but I commend you for the elegance and the balance that you have in your wines. And I just wondered what the genesis of that was, because much of Australia, and in particular the Barossa Valley, has trended toward the jammier fruit and the higher alcohol, and you've sort of kept an even keel about it.
We've had a philosophy all along. One, we don't follow trends, because trends are trends. But probably more importantly, we believe that 9 bottles out of 10 or 11 out of 12, whatever it is, of Jacob's Creek are going to be consumed in and around food. And that it's very important that the wine that we produce is complementary. Now, some of these great big desiccator styles are a lovely drink. They're interesting wines, but they're not truly food wines, and they're probably not made to be food wines, mm-hmm. because they're not made in enormous quantities. They're curios in the nice sense. I'm not saying that they're curios peculiar, but
they're cocktails.
Yeah.
Exactly. A wine cocktail.
Exactly. Sure. Now, you can't be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. And the philosophy in Jacob's Creek, at all levels, classic, reserve, and the heritage collection, is wines that are very much to be designed to be drunk with food, and hence the importance of elegance. You know, the last thing you want is the wine to overwhelm the food. Mm-hmm. Bernard mentioned balance, and you know, that's probably the key thing, the wines where every part of it's balanced, and then if you have those sort of balanced wines with, you know, with most foods, you end up with a balanced meal.
Well, you know, before we started the show, you were talking about the wine market in China, and you're going to go visit China after your tour of the United States. And I've been to Australia several times. I don't get there as often as I would like, but I know that Asian cuisine is huge in Australia. And it just seems to me that a more balanced red wine, if you're going to have a red wine with Asian food, you want something that has a little more balance and elegance to it. Mm-hmm. Would be my guess.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And we have not adapted the style of Jacob's Creek for the Chinese market. What we have certainly done is identify that the Chinese market at the moment predominantly drinks red, so we can't force them to drink white. We certainly offer white wines because there's clearly a future there. So we have to provide the varieties they want, but we haven't modified the style of Jacob's Creek because you're quite right. Jacob's Creek at the moment sits very, very comfortably with a whole range of Asian foods, Chinese, Japanese, or what have you. And there'd be no point. And secondly, I think it might be quite dangerous to try and second guess these things.
You know, speaking of white wines, I run several big wine competitions here in the United States. And your Riesling, your Reserve Riesling, has done extremely well, extraordinarily well. You know, it's won not just gold medals, but, you know, best of show, sweepstakes wines. Tell me this story of Jacob's Creek Riesling. Has it always been part of the portfolio?
I'll let Bernard answer that because he's the bloke who should take the credit for where Jacob's Creek Riesling is today.
Well, I think the credit really goes to the sort of the history of all the winemakers through the company because we've been going for well over 160 years now as a wine business. And that was the first variety that we started off with. So Riesling has been part of our winemaking since day one. The Jacob's Creek Riesling, or what we call the classic Riesling, that was launched back in 1984, I think. And so that's been around a long time too. When we talk about Riesling in our business, it's very much about passion and love for the variety. And The interesting thing about what's happened over the last 20 years in Australia is that the Riesling style is now quite dry, which you'd probably be aware of, and we've been able to get away with that with the Riesling variety. Riesling is actually naturally high in acid, and you need to balance off that sort of natural acidity with something. And fortunately, in Australia, and with the vineyards that we Riesling vines that we source for Jacob's Creek, we're able to ripen the fruit to the point where there's enough flavour through the mid-palate, those lovely citrus lime flavours. And that's the thing that balances off the acidity. Some people even say, well, hang on a minute, this wine almost tastes sweet, but it is the fruit flavour that gives you the perception of sweetness, which then balances off the acid. When you've got that style of Riesling, you've got a delicious wine that just matches with so much food in terms of delicate seafoods or Asian cuisine, etc. Yeah. And in fact, today in Australia now, nearly all the Riesling that's consumed and loved in Australia is dry Riesling. We don't have to state it on the label because the consumer knows it's dry.
The assumption is that it's a dry Riesling.
The assumption is that it's dry.
You know, when I first became interested in Australian wines, it seemed counterintuitive to me that Australia would be a place to source wonderful Riesling. And I've come to love Rieslings from the Clare Valley and in Barossa from the Eden Valley. Mm. What is it about the climate and the soil that makes it generous toward Riesling and makes it possible for you to make a really great dry Riesling?
Well, firstly, we have ancient soils, it's our you know, Australia is a very ancient continent. It's not a recent sort of, you know, volcanic event. Mm-hmm. So, being an ancient continent, it means that the soils are weathered and low in fertility, and that is one of the aspects that tends to make the Riesling, which is normally a fairly vigorous vine, makes it struggle in those soils a little bit, mm-hmm. Moderates the yield, and then produces intense flavour, which is that lime citrus flavour that I was telling you about. Eden Valley and Clare are both high altitude vineyards, so we can actually counteract the sort of warmth of the summers in Australia with vineyards grown at 400, 500, 550 metres above sea level. And at that higher altitude, you get much colder nights, which helps Riesling in terms of protecting its acid level, mm-hmm. Natural acidity, and also retains those delicate citrus aromas and flavours in the grape. And by, you know, pitching the vineyards at certain sites in terms of aspect and the altitude, we virtually know on the right soil type that we'll produce a high quality Riesling.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know in the Barossa and Eden Valley, you're really not that far from the Southern Ocean. Mm. Is there any influence that helps the grapes?
Yeah, there is. I mean, when it blows from the north, it can get pretty hot, mm-hmm. because that's where the desert is,
sure.
In the middle of Australia. But normally when we get those northerly winds, it's often, I guess, preceding what we call a cold front, mm-hmm. which comes through on about a 7 to 10 day basis normally. So we know that the wind will swing round to the south-southwest, and that wind will eventually blow through Clare, Barossa, Eden Valley, because it's only about 30 kilometres off the coast. So within an hour, we're back to a cool sea breeze. And it blows all that heat away and blows the heat out of the vines. And
sure.
And then the next 4 or 5 days, we've got lovely temperatures in the mid-20s, which is what Riesling loves to produce varietal wine.
You know what I'm curious about, and either one of you or both of you can answer this. We know that at one time, Australia predominantly was sweet wine. That's what you made. How did Australia come to acquire this taste for dry Riesling?
Well, you're right. We used to be a nation who drank sweet wine, and it's not all that long ago that we drank more fortified wine and sweet fortified wine, mm-hmm. than table wine. It was really only in the 1970s, which in the scheme of things is not that long ago,
sure, yeah.
that we started to drink more table wine than fortified wine. And initially those table wines were things like, in the case of Orlando, Barossa Pearl.
And what was Barossa Pearl?
Well, Barossa Pearl was a very attractive, fairly neutral, tank fermented sparkling wine.
Okay.
But it was lowish alcohol, sweet, but it brought people into drinking Australian, mm-hmm. wine. Lindeman's had a product called Benin Moselle, similar but not sparkling. But they were sweet. They weren't overtly sweet, but they were soft, easy drinking wines, relying on sugar, and they brought people into drinking wine. And it wasn't all that long before those people who were drinking those sorts of wines started to look for something a little bit drier. These were nice drinks, but they weren't great food wines, this, mm-hmm. whole argument about food. And we progressively became a slightly more sophisticated, not in the wrong way, but sophisticated wine drinkers, and people looked for drier wines. Initially, they were drier white wines, and then increasingly drier red wines. So it's a fairly natural evolution. I think you can see it. You can see the same pattern, actually, at roughly about the same time that occurred in certainly in California. Mm-hmm. East Coast probably a little bit different because that was a more European basis.
But, very much so.
We could see similarities in California that were happening in Australia. So it was an evolution, and the wine styles obviously evolved to meet that. But
now, I know beer is big in Australia, but has wine always been part of the culture? You know, in terms of people put wine on the table with dinner in the evening?
since the 1950s, yes. Prior to that, there was a wine industry.
I think it actually started later here in the United States, more like the 70s, yeah. and it really didn't start to pick up steam until the 80s, and then now it's kind of on fire. But for a long time there, we were a gin and tonic country, beer.
Yeah, we were not such a big spirits country. I mean, mm-hmm. if we were, it was Scotch. And there were, in fact, a lot of Australian whiskies that have subsequently disappeared. But it was predominantly beer. There wasn't a lot of money in Australia until the sort of 1960s, when wool prices skyrocketed and there were export earnings that made the whole country wealthy. And it was a gradual thing that, again, these sweet white wines mm-hmm. brought people into drinking wine. Prior to that, it was something a bit special. You might have sparkling wine, which in those days we called champagne at weddings and what have you.
Sure.
And that would have been people's total experience, other than this strange drink called sparkling Burgundy.
You know, and I have to think wine is one of your biggest exports now. Is it
one of our biggest agricultural exports?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Sure. Yeah. Tell me about the, I know you pronounce it, I'm going to say funny, you're going to say you pronounce it right, but Semillon, or what we call Semillon. Tell me about Semillon in Australia.
Well, the history of Semillon is a little bit like the history of Riesling in Australia, that when phylloxera went around the world in the 1880s, mm-hmm. Australia put an embargo or quarantine on any vine material coming into the country, and that prevailed until about 1970. So what we had in the 1880s is what we had until quite recently, and we didn't have Chardonnay. It actually subsequently turned mm-hmm. out we had it, but we didn't know we had it. So the white grapes of Australia were Semillon and Riesling. And Semillon was all-purpose. It was called Hunter River Riesling. Mm-hmm. And it was used to make a generic Riesling, a generic white Burgundy, and a generic Chablis. A number of varieties sort of fitted into the Riesling category. So they were the varieties we had. Semillon dominated in the Hunter. Riesling dominated in South Australia. So the two styles sort of evolved. The Hunter being close to Sydney, which has always been the largest population centre, got initially the biggest push because that was the mm-hmm. that was the local white wine, suited the Hunter and was quite versatile, because if you wanted Chablis today, you'd drink something made from Semillon, didn't say so on the label. Mm-hmm. If you wanted Riesling and you lived in New South Wales, you'd drink a Riesling made from Semillon, because it was people sort of manipulated the style to fit the generic name.
Yeah. But, you know, the Semillon that we're familiar with is from the Hunter Valley, is a very lean, acidic, almost green wine that when it matures, changes personality completely. Mm-hmm. The Semillon from the Barossa Valley is completely different. Was that a transition for you when you made the big switch from the Hunter to the Barossa?
It was, and I've never actually made that switch. I'm still a staunch believer in Hunter River Semillon. It's one of the few areas that Bernard and I disagree a little bit on. Uh-huh. And that sort of Chablis style from the Hunter, I find absolutely fascinating. You've got to have a bit of patience, of course, mm-hmm. whereas there's a lot more generosity in the Barossa style, and I'll let Bernard talk about that.
Sure. Tell us about a Barossa Semillon.
Okay, Semillon, I guess more flavour up front mm-hmm. Than the... I think you mentioned before that the Hunter Semillon style, fairly lean and sort of understated as a young wine, but when they develop with age, from the great vintages, I might add, because mm-hmm. it can be a bit up and down, they turn into very charming wines that often win the wine of the show in the shows back in Australia, because they age so brilliantly. Barossa Semillon is much more upfront fruit on the nose and palate. They are... from the better vintages on the right soil, they're absolutely delicious wines as young, and well made will age as well, and probably won't live the same distance as the great Hunter Semillons, but I guess more appealing as a younger, fruitier style of Semillon. Mm-hmm. Now, if you reflect on that these days, you know, contemporary winemaking and wine consumer trends are to drink wines, to make and consume wines when they're fresh and young. Probably the Barossa style is a little bit more contemporary in that regard, that if you had to make a Semillon in Australia and you wanted to go to market quickly and it was a fruit-driven style, you'd probably lean towards that style of Semillon, because it has a lot of a fruit aroma and flavour, typically of sort of lemon, lemongrass, snow pea, pea pod, those sort of notes typically, and they're attractive wines. Yeah.
You know, before we went on the air, we talked a little bit about how Jacob's Creek was introduced here in the United States. And it was introduced with your basic, introductory line of wines, which were very good value for the money, you know, good quality for the price that was paid. And you, Phil, said that you felt that that was a mistake because you had higher tiered wines that you could have introduced and demonstrated to people that Jacob's Creek was had more to offer. But by the same token, I think we can all agree that Jacob's Creek has really been on the march in recent vintages, and quality has been on the rise. And what do you attribute that to?
Well, it comes back to the Jacob's Creek philosophy, and from the top of the company down, for the last 20 years, there's been an absolute commitment, and it's sort of almost written into the winemaker's job description, that we can never take a step backwards. Each vintage, the aim is to make it slightly more appealing, and I use the word appealing rather than necessarily better, but more appealing than the previous vintage. Now, in practice, you can't always do that because of the season, but we are never allowed to take a step backwards. And if that means less wine from that vintage, so be it. So this is sort of part of the discipline. And Bernard referred to this before, the significant improvements in Australian viticulture, and they have been enormous over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob's Creek has almost every vintage got a little bit better and a little bit better. And in more recent years, those steps have been larger because there's been plenty of fruit, plenty of high quality fruit available. So it's made that task easier. And you're right, take something like Jacob's Creek Shiraz Cabernet. I mean, in this market, it's a standout wine. It's staggering quality for the price that people have to pay for it. So
sure.
There's been discipline, but also a little bit of good luck of having some.
Well, you know, and I think your point is well taken. And I know that you travel the world, and you're aware that in places like southern Italy that used to make really sort of mediocre wine 25, 30 years ago, they're making phenomenal wines today. And all these parts of the world where modern viticulture has sort of come to the fore. We're seeing quality on the rise. Chile, Argentina, I mean, 30 years ago, you really wouldn't be raving about too much of the wines that were coming out of South America, and now we have some phenomenal things. And we've seen that, in Australia as well, although I do think that you were kind of more on a par with the United States, further ahead of the curve than South America, so you were probably the leaders in the Southern Hemisphere.
Probably a fair comment. And Australia, this is not blowing the bags of Australia, but it's real.
That's okay. You're on the show.
You're okay.
You can blow your horn.
It is the investment that Australia put into viticultural research has been, in the last 20 years, greater than any other country. And we put a lot more money and effort into viticulture than we did into winemaking. I mean, winemaking wasn't neglected, but we figured that the big issues in winemaking had probably been solved in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and that what we needed to address going forward was the source material for our wine. So a lot of work went into vastly improved viticulture, a much greater understanding of how we look after the soil, the physiology of the grapevine, how we prune vines, and more importantly, I think, about vineyard variability, that vineyards that once might have been 30 or 40 acres are now really assembly of a whole lot of little vineyards of 5 acres. It might look like a 40-acre vineyard, but we manage it as 8 5-acre vineyards or whatever it might be. And each of those lots is separately described, separately managed, separately harvested. And those sorts of things have made an unbelievable difference to the quality of Australian wine, treating our independent growers as if they were our own vineyards, requiring them to work as we do. If they don't want to, they can go work, supply fruit for someone else.
You know, we're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon, but you are both here visiting the United States and taking a tour. I understand you just came in from New York, and then you're going to go up to San Francisco and then up to the Napa Valley. What do you hope to accomplish on a trip like this? Are you ambassadors for Australian wine, or are you ambassadors for Jacob's Creek, or both?
Both, I guess. But I think every Australian winemaker who comes to the United States, or for that matter, any part of the world, is sufficiently generous to talk about Australia as a whole. It's one of the successes of, I guess, the Australian wine industry that we work together. Having said that, obviously we're going to build that Australianisation, Australianism around Jacob's Creek.
Jacob's Creek, sure.
As somebody from another company would build it around there.
Are you surprised by your success in the U.S. market? And I don't think I'm overstating it to say that you've been phenomenally successful here in the United States, going from basically zero to 60 in about, what, 10 years?
Yeah. It's to be honest, it's been a little patchy. Some markets we've done remarkably well. Others we perhaps haven't done quite so well, and I guess one of the things that we're doing in this trip is trying to understand the dynamics of why we work so well in some markets, not quite so well in others. Is it the way that the distribution system is structured, or is it that we just did a much better job in some places than other places?
And how has the worldwide recession affected you? Are you insulated a little bit because the dollar is weaker and your dollar is stronger now, or is it just sort of nasty out there for everyone?
Well, that's a two-edged sword. I mean, the strength of the Australian dollar has been wonderful for the Australian economy overall.
Mm-hmm.
It's not been terribly good for exports of Australian wine because, you know, it's estimated that we could be close to parity with the US dollar by the end of the year, which makes exporting much, much more difficult. So there's been win or lose. Australia as a whole has had a much better ride through the recession than any other country, and a lot of that's to do with mineral exports to China, a succession of governments that have managed the country very well in a fiscal sense, a more regulated banking system. There's a whole lot of things.
Sure,
we've come through it, but wine exports are by and large still good. It'd be silly not to say that we're hurting badly in the United Kingdom, and in fact, almost every country, wine exporting country, is hurting in the United Kingdom because they seem to have been hit harder than most.
Yeah. You know, you're going to the Napa Valley, and that's an area that has been especially hard hit because the theme, and they just had a financial symposium in Napa, I believe, a couple of days ago. Today's Friday, so it would have been Wednesday. And they were talking about people trading down and buying less expensive wines. And then the big question became, when the recession is over, are they going to go back to the more expensive wines? And I have my own theory. I think that once people find out that, you know, for $20, they can drink very nice wine for $18, $15, you don't necessarily have to spend $75 unless you're getting something really unique.
I think you're right.
Have you seen that dynamic in Australia as well?
Yeah, most definitely.
Where people are trading down.
People are trading down. People are still drinking as much wine, but they're you know, exactly what you say. The person who was the $30 drinker is now a $15 drinker, and they've been quite surprised that at $15 they can actually get very, very good wine. So, you know, there will be a permanent change now. Whether that's the same in 10 or 15 years, who knows? But I think for the short term, it's going to be great for wine drinkers and great for winemakers who fill that place in the market.
Okay, one last question. If somebody came up to you in your travels here in the U.S. and said, Phil or Bernard, what is Jacob's Creek's benchmark wine? What would you say?
Benchmark wine?
Your flagship.
Yeah, well, for me, I would go back to the great success story of Jacob's Creek, which is our Jacob's Creek Shiraz Cabernet. I think as a wine that's, and every time we taste that, and I was saying before that that's the one that we do the verticals on, vertical tastings, and it always shows up well. It's a very complete wine. It's that that classic blend of Shiraz and Cabernet where you've got the flavour of the Shiraz and then the structure of the Cabernet. It's a great food wine. It's just a complete wine from Jacob's Creek, and it's still as good today as it ever was when it was first launched.
Well, gentlemen, I think we're going to end on this note. Phil, you said earlier that you don't follow trends, and I think, Bernard, you're talking about the Shiraz Cabernet blend. You actually set a trend, because if you look around here in California now, everybody is blending Syrah, what you call Shiraz, with Cabernet and Merlot, and it's become very popular. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. That's all we have time for this week. Until next time, this is Robert Whitley saying ciao.